My name is Chris Risden. I'm a lead experience designer at Adaptive Path, and I'm here out of the Austin studio. And I'm going to be talking today about behavior design. And I'm going to be talking about it from the perspective of a practitioner. There's a lot of people much, much smarter than me that have sort of created the foundation for the thinking behind designing for behavior change and persuasive technology. And the point of view that I've sort of taken the past 2-3 years when I've kind of dived into the subject was that of my day-to-day practitioner life. So what is it about it that I can apply to designing products and services day in, day out? So in that vein, we're going to be taking sort of a reporter's point of view on the subject. We're going to be talking about the what, why, where, and how. Sort of what are we talking about, lay a little bit of foundation so that we kind of have a common frame of reference. Why now? Why has it sort of hit a tipping point or a critical mass in our discussions and an application to being product managers, user experience designers, and interaction designers? And then kind of where does it live? How do we start to recognize it in the wild? And not just, you know, recognizing patterns that we see every day that have been highlighted in a lot of presentations, but really where does it live in the ecosystem of our products and services that we design, particularly if you're doing digital design or service design? And then how do we apply it? So how does it actually integrate into our current processes? We do things like research and synthesis and ideation. Where does it sort of live at that point? It's kind of matching the fact that there's a lot of theory and academia out there, and then there's sort of these patterns that we see and get cited as examples, and I'm trying to fill, my goal has been the past few years is to start to fill the gap as a practitioner. So we'll start with why behavior design, and to a lesser extent, why persuasive, or what is behavior design, and what is persuasive technology. And I think the reason it's kind of come more to the forefront in our discussions was around 2009 when it sort of started to become the next big thing. You know, social media was really big, and then gamification also started being big, and things like behavior design, designing for influence, persuasive technology also became a lot bigger. It wasn't that it was going to necessarily be the next big thing, but it started to be more topical. And so Adaptive Path's general manager, Brandon Schauer, actually had a set of 9 predictions for 2009, and one of them was to enable behavior change and among any things. And the idea that you might want to extend your paycheck, you might want to conserve your energy, but there's ways now as designers we're starting to support these types of behavior motivations. And then also 2009, Robert Fabricant, who's the executive creative director at Frog, had a presentation at Interaction 9 in Vancouver, which is the IXDA Interactions and Designers Conference, where he sort of had a premise that the behavior is the medium that we work in, we as interaction designers, in that context, and that it's not about channels or the technology or what way they're enabled. It's more about the fact that we're supporting or influencing behaviors. And that kind of supported and sort of resonated with me, and I had already started to kind of investigate it because as a designer, in the broadest sense, both I've been a project manager or a product manager, I've been an information architect, and I'm an interaction designer. In the broadest sense of designing products and services, I've always felt that every design decision we make influences the user in some way. And however benevolent that may be, so it might not be our intent is to create some sort of big attitude shift or behavior change, but anything we do affects how people perceive the system that we're designing and thus influences their behavior. And the best analogy I typically use for that is documentary filmmaking. When it sort of came in prominence along with cinema in general in the early 20th century, documentary filmmaking as a counterpart to fictional filmmaking, filmmaking that's scripted or reenacted, was sort of the objective form of filmmaking. People either that were theoricians or cinemaphiles kind of termed it as life as it is or kind of the way you film what is in front of you. But the fact of the matter is, you're creating a constraint by time and space. There's a constraint of how people watch that movie, where they watch it, and definitely a framing of time, whether that's 1 hour or 2 hours or whatever kind of framework you're presenting the story in. And so within that constraints, you have to make decisions as a designer or a filmmaker. And those decisions, from a filmmaking standpoint, could be where you decide to point the camera, who you decide to interview, whether you add a musical score or not, and the way you edit the film, the way in which you tell that story, is going to influence the way the audience receives that story. and more specifically, how they perceive or understand that story. And it's no different for us as interaction designers or even people who manage products and services. So that gets us to the ubiquitous define the damn thing slide within behavior design. And the caveat is that these are my definitions. This is kind of my synthesis as a practitioner about what these things mean in the context of designing products and services. So they're not official, they're not academic. They kind of adhere to things you've probably heard before if you've looked up the topic, but they're sort of my synthesis and my kind of interpretation of what these are. And so behavior design, I consider short for designing for behavior change. I don't think those are two different things. I think it's just a shorthand way of saying something that's kind of long, which is designed for behavior change. And I think it's designing with the intent to change someone's behavior or attitude. Whereas persuasive technology is technology designed to persuade the user to use a system or a platform in a desired way. And so behavior design generally, as a generalization, is about affecting the user's behavior. So you're the designer and you want to affect how they behave or how their attitudes are that's relative to their personal life. The persuasive technology is typically going to be how you design so that they use your system in a desired way. And it's sort of a bit of a macro, micro type of thing. You're typically going to see products and services that, if they fall under that category, are going to be behavior design. And you're going to typically see features within any kind of system that are designed to sort of have you use it a certain way, the way you fill out a form, the way you might go through an e-commerce funnel. Those types of things are going to be how you want to motivate the user to use your system in a certain way. So thinking about what it is, I'm going to kind of cover a couple of like these key pillars that we see, but it is just the tip of the iceberg, but it kind of will help make sure that we're sort of have this common frame of reference. And we typically start with BJ Fogg, and he heads up the Persuasive Technology Lab at Stanford University. The moment if any of you guys have researched the subject, you've probably already come up with to his name. And he's really showing that even before our new sort of interconnected mobile environments, we've been doing a lot of thinking about how technology can persuade our behaviors and our attitudes. He wrote the book Persuasive Technology, I think in 2001, so well over 2 years ago, well before smartphones and kind of Wi-Fi and that kind of pervasive networked ability. And then he's been researching it a lot longer. And so he's created this Fogg behavior model. And what he's done is paired motivations with abilities. So the idea of how motivated you are, motivation not being binary, but being something that can be on a scale. You could be moderately motivated, you could be highly motivated, with your ability to actually do something, engage in a behavior, whether it's easy or hard. And then he's sort of created this activation threshold, which identifies the area where your motivation outweighs the difficulty of your ability, so you're more likely to complete it. And the goal is to put the trigger in the right space. Now, to illustrate this, I try to think of like one of the more simpler ways that I can illustrate this concept. And hopefully you recognize 90999 is the text messaging number to donate $10 to the Red Cross when an event happens, typically some type of natural disaster somewhere or similar things. So imagine yourself maybe around 2005, maybe 2004, 2005, and you're sitting at an airport, and you got like a two-hour layover. So you go to the airport bar to have a beer, and the TV is on. And so the TV's on, and there's some disaster that is being reported on a news channel, maybe halfway across the world. So you're seeing stories about maybe how many people have died, how many people are injured, a lot of data points, you know, what the 5 billion in damages, things like that. And then you get a call to action on that where they say, you know, the Red Cross is going to be obviously needing to supply blood, food, housing, medical services. So you should go to the redcross.org and donate some money when you get a chance. Now, this isn't close to home. It's halfway across the world, and you don't know anyone involved. So you have a lot of empathy for it, but you don't necessarily are highly motivated because it doesn't hit close to home. Instead, it's more that you're moderately motivated because you see that, and it's a tragic story, and it's being told in a way where you can really see the richness of the tragedy, so you're kind of moderately motivated. Now, this is 2005, so what you have to do is you have to remember that you want to donate to the Red Cross. So you have to wait for your plane, you have to, you know, get home from your flight, which might be 3, 4, 5 hours. You have to remember that you wanted to donate in the first place. You have to remember about what you saw on television, and then you have to get on your computer, and you have to log on, and you have to go through what's basically, when you go to the Red Cross, an e-commerce filter or funnel, because you need to give up some billing information, your credit card number, and then you kind of have to think about how much do I want to donate? I mean, I don't want to be cheap. I really want to feel good about myself and help out, and I want to feel good about that. So all those things are things that are related to how motivated you are when you're in that airport bar to donating money. Right now, if you had five people that all saw that same message, you know, I don't know what percentage it is, but I would imagine it's more like one out of five of those people would be motivated enough to go through those steps in order to do that. And now if we have today and we have the text messaging, it's a whole other story. What you have is the fact that you can see that story, you can have that empathy, and you can be moderately motivated. And now in this case, your ability matches your motivation. Your motivation is actually higher than the difficulty of your ability. So you can get out your phone. It doesn't even have to be a smartphone. It can be a feature phone. You can text 90999, you know, whatever keyword the event has, like Haiti or something like that. And then, you know, $10 is seamlessly deducted from your phone bill. So it's not even that much, but you can still feel good about the fact that you acted when you were really motivated to. So that simple thing allows us to seize opportune moments by being able to increase the ability to match that. So if you had five people at that airport bar, a higher percentage of them will act on it because the act was so easy and it matched their level of motivation. Within 30 seconds, they're done. And I'm suppressing a cough, and I have a cough drop, so if I make a dramatic pause to get some water, bear with me. So we see this in smaller ways around our lives as well, just to illustrate the point. You know, if you're at a pet store, for example, and you're buying all your pet supplies, and imagine how likely you would be to donate to, say, the ASPCA or some local shelter if they gave you a flyer and said, you should really think about donating, and the flyer had some statistics and it had a URL to go donate, and you took it with you and you said, yeah, of course, I'm at the pet store, I care about animals, so I'll think about donating. The likelihood that you would donate versus a system where at the point of sale, when you've already got your supplies, you're already spending $50 on pet supplies, and there's a prompt on the point of purchase credit card swipe that says, would you like to donate $1 to the ASPCA? You care about pets, and you already have $50, so what's $51? So what's the likelihood of you to be able to do that? And so it's interesting, and I like the FOG behavior model because it's a great framework to see it. You know, one of the things that it doesn't have is obviously how do you actually measure those, but it's a way to start thinking about the problem and framing the problem. But it's not also a new thing. We've been thinking about the idea of increasing motivation or reducing friction or lowering barriers for quite some time, especially in marketing. I remember seeing graphs like this when I was in marketing in the early 90s and thinking about how we're always trying to make someone more motivated to continue some type of process or some type of funnel. So it's an interesting framework, and it's one we've been thinking about a lot, but it's starting to get a little more crystallized in the context of our kind of technology-enabled world. Someone else to highlight is Robert Cialdini. And in the 90s, he wrote a book called Influence, the Psychology of Persuasion. And this was in the 90s, and this really had little to do with technology, which is, again, highlighting how long we've actually been talking about this, or that people, psychologists typically, and behavioral economists, have been thinking about our ability to persuade each other, whether directly or through things, some sort of intermediary like technology. And he created these six weapons of influence. And I think that's sort of telling for the time and the idea that it was probably marketing influence, that it's weapons of influence. But he talks about them, and yet they're still, and this was in the 90s, but they're still really relevant today, or at least the fact that they're really pervasive today. Anything to do with social media, you're going to recognize a lot of these sort of high-level concepts and patterns that he talks about applying. When he talked about them, he wasn't even thinking in a technology sense, but reciprocity, commitment, and consistency, the idea that once you commit to something sort of verbally or in some other way by signing up, you're going to be more likely to follow through. Social proof, the idea that you might be more likely to do something when you see others do it. Authority, the idea that credibility would be more likely for you to do something. Liking, the idea that if you like something and have a positive emotions about it, you'll be more likely to do it. Scarcity, we see that when we get limited betas to sign up for, the idea that scarcity will create interest and will create demand. So these things are still very pervasive and are very much thought about, and there's sort of similar heuristics that exist that have kind of existed for two or three decades that have become almost more prominent now that we're more technologically enabled. And then there's Dan Ariely, and this is an area that I've really been interested in. He's a behavior economist, and he's written two books. One is Predictably Irrational, and the other is The Upside of Irrationality. So as a behavior economist, someone that thinks about how people make decisions and kind of guide their own behaviors, I think you can understand the tact that he thinks. You know, the irrationality is really in there. And to sort of illustrate his overall view about how people make their decisions, he gave an anecdote in an interview I saw a couple years ago. And what he did is he talked about a situation. He said, let's say it's you and me, and I'm in front of you, and I have a box of chocolates. And it's a full box of chocolates, and you can see it, and I'm ready to hand it over to you. And I tell you, I'll give you half a box of these chocolates now. Or you have a choice, you can wait a week and get the full box of chocolates. And of course, from a return on investment standpoint, the waiting the week to get double your box of chocolates is the rational decision to make. But any study they did, any research they did that sort of mimicked this scenario actually had people pick the half box of chocolates. They were thinking not rationally about what was in their best interest, but motivated more by impulse and by what was more concrete. The fact that I could actually grab that box of chocolates, take it now, and I'd be doing it. A little more abstract if I have to wait a week. And what was interesting is, and to illustrate that point, is that he gave a second scenario, which was, let's say I have this box of chocolates, and if you wait 1 month, I'll give you a half box of chocolates. And if you wait 1 month and 1 week, I'll give you the whole box of chocolates. All of a sudden there, it became, when you shifted out that time and you didn't make it about immediate decisions, it became a lot more rational for you to, and a lot more easy for you to make the decision that's in your best self-interest, which is to get the whole box of chocolates by waiting 1 more week. And I saw one more thing. It was a blog post on Fast Company about a year ago, and it was about active design, big A, big D, and it was a set of guidelines they were developing in New York City to guide the development of buildings and city spaces in a way that would help fight obesity through architecture and the city planning. And it was city planners, urban planners, architects, and the government working on these guidelines. And one of the takeaways they realized when they were thinking about how to do this was the fact that this quote, which says that the strategy recognizes that the public's underlying motivations are not about health, but rather about what is convenient and enjoyable. And that sort of is an extension of what Dan Ariely is talking about. And then lastly, when we're kind of giving a very tip of the iceberg landscape about behavior design are a lot of patterns and heuristics that are making their way that are really useful. Dan Lochtin is a PhD researcher out of Brunel University in the UK, and he has the Design with Intent Toolkit, which are a set of design patterns, or basically behavior influencing patterns that you can kind of use to motivate, ideate around strategies to influence behavior. You're going to see things like benches that are designed so you can't sleep on them. You got things like the nail polish that's bitter, so if you use it, you won't bite your nails. Those types of heuristics and patterns. Steven Anderson has his mental note cards, which sort of combine some Gestalt theory with some other sort of persuasion principles. And I think they're really useful for getting ideas and starting to understand a lot of the concepts that are floating around. And Fabrique, a design consultancy, has their insight cards, which are actually for visual designers and do a lot of Gestalt theory and things about perception, so how you can influence perception through visual design. Again, that's the tip of the iceberg. We could spend the whole session covering the basics of and the landscape of the research and the theory that's out there. But that should hopefully at least make it a little less abstract if it's something that you're actually new to thinking about. So we come back to the why now, or in this case, why 2009, which is where I sort of saw the tipping point or the critical mass occur in the talking about behavior design. And it's easy to sort of point to technology and the pervasiveness of it and mobile technology specifically, but I think there's some specific underpinnings that really drive the product and service explosion we're seeing around it. And I start with data. And I like this because as someone who started as an information architect, it kind of hits close to home, and I like the fact that there's still some of these relevant problems for information architects to solve. And what we have is the idea that data has this ability to tell a story. And what we have now more than ever is this ability to passively collect data. It's something that we did not have before. And what happens is we go from that information architecture and that data standpoint, and then we add our interaction design standpoint, which is almost all about feedback loops, that idea that when someone interacts with our interfaces or our systems, we have a feedback loop for them. It kind of becomes a dialogue. That's sort of the underpinning of interaction design. So we have the data, and then we have feedback loop about the data. And what that sort of does is create this sort of flow, and this is kind of an actual theory, the idea of turning data into information and into knowledge. And it's kind of starting data points and making that story out of it, and then turning that story into knowledge that you can act on. If we think about our CNN story, what those stories are done, visually rich, but what they're doing is creating a story out of data point information, where it occurred, how big the impact of the tragedy was, how many deaths or injuries or homes lost, or how many billions of dollars in damage it is. And that's what tells the story that we turn into information. And that's the information that'll motivate us to do something like donate to the Red Cross. So what we have now is this ability to passively, or at the very least in a low effort way, get data about ourselves that we can act on, or get data about other things that we also can act on. And then we can visualize it. And when we visualize that data, it tells a story about us. And it tells a story about us that affects us in that sort of emotional level, kind of the level that we're looking at from things like Dan Ariely and the behavior economists that are looking at. And if I could illustrate this, one way is to think about 2 decades ago and you wanted to maybe manage your finances. So your really only option was to dive into your check register. This is how you found out how much you had in your bank account at any given time besides actually going to the bank. You had to write down every purchase. Hopefully you did it as you made it or else you might forget about it. And every month you had to reconcile it. And it was your sort of diary, if you think about it from a research and reporting standpoint, it was your diary or your journal of your activities. And the only way you could do it is to actually dive in, scan your purchases if you wanted to actually look at your finances and see how much you had in your bank and think about how you were managing your finances. And then we eventually got spreadsheets, which helped with some of the heavy lifting because we were able to look at month to month or week to week or anything like that and start to look at trends at a high level. So what we still have here are data points, but they aren't telling that much of a compelling story, so they're not having that big of an influence, let alone the fact that the collection of data, if we think about those motivations and those abilities, the collection of data is very manual. You have to be highly motivated if you wanted to use this system in order to manage your finances and influence your spending behavior, your saving behavior. And then we had in the 90s the rise of Microsoft Money and Quicken. When they first came out, it was still very manual. You weren't connected to the internet, so you still, like a check registry, had to enter all your data. But now all of a sudden they did some heavy lifting for you in which they were able to tell that data and give you the feedback loop and tell you something about that data and tell you a story about your behaviors. And you're able to, in a visually rich way, see what you did relative to your budget and your spending or your savings and your income and look at that over time and space as well, which is really important. And now we get to the point now where it's completely passive. Once we give up our username and passwords to our financial institutions, the data is collected for us. We don't even have to think about it. We have great feedback loops in a number of ways. We can see the visually rich data that presents itself as a story. We can get alerts and prompts when we do something bad or there's doing something good. So all of a sudden we have this data and we have the way to interact with it, the feedback loop, and that tells a story that's going to inform our decisions. And we see that in almost all the products that are starting to explode and go into the space. This is Nest, the thermostat that is intelligent, and it looks at your behaviors, and it makes intelligent choices about how to help you conserve energy. And what it is doing is collecting data about how you're presenting it, how much energy you're using, and is giving you feedback on your behaviors, and it's also making intelligent choices for you about that, all based on data and feedback loops and sort of telling that story of your behaviors around this activity, which is obviously heating your house or energy conservation. So I think that's why we've seen that it's become important and sort of what it's starting to look like. And there's a lot more we can cover. There's, obviously we haven't talked about things like gamification. But I think even if you look at gamification, it's gotten kind of unfairly reduced to things like, badges and levels and points. But even when you do look at that as kind of this kind of visual representation of it, that's still based on data and the feedback loops. You're doing something, you're having behaviors within the game, that's collecting data and you're getting feedback about your progress, whether that's the form of badges, the form of points, or the form of any kind of reward system. So now we kind of understand that, we're going to look at where does it live. So what are we looking at kind of in our product ecosystem? And what we have is the word persuasion is kind of a loaded word with what we're doing because it has these ethical implications. It sounds very manipulative or deceptive, and people can kind of fear it. And a lot of people come from a tact of being like usability specialists and people who want to enable things, and the idea of persuading people to potentially do what they don't want to do is kind of scary. But it's really not as cut and dry, and it's not as a binary as that. You have on one end of the spectrum things that are basically like usability or utility, and that's kind of a micro-macro thing. Things that are more feature-oriented are probably going to be geared around usability. Things that are maybe more products and services might you think of in the context of utility. And then on the other side, you have persuasion, the idea of persuading somebody to change their behaviors or their attitudes or to persuade someone to use a system in a certain way. So take something that that would be considered a persuasive technique, and that would be trialability. And trialability is that idea that if you see something demonstrated or you get to use it in a way, you're more likely to engage in that service, so you're more likely to have a behavior where you'll use that. You can see that in anything from a screencast for products to the idea of progressive engagement, the idea that you can sort of use the product before you can need to sign up for it. It's really what things like test driving a car is based on. So trialability is a technique that is firmly in the sense is in the sense of persuasion. But now if you took it from a usability expert or perhaps a information architect's perspective, trialability can aid cognition, it can aid understanding. So the idea of being able to demonstrate how a product works means that they're gonna have a more successful and more enjoyable time with that product, they'll use it successfully, they'll make less errors. So all of a sudden you realize that it kind of involves both. There's sort of the self-interest that you have in wanting to engage in the behavior, and then there's the customer value that it has in actually helping them understand the product and service. And so as you already saw the slide, Amazon OneClick is one that I like to use. And when it comes to buying books on my iPad, I call it one crack because I just kind of keep on pressing it. And Amazon OneClick clearly comes out of a persuasive sort of thing. Amazon wants you to buy more goods and services. They want to persuade you. And of course, it's something e-commerce has dealt with for the decade plus that they've been around, in that they want to reduce that friction that we talked about, making it easier to go through the checkout so you're less likely to abandon it. You started checking out for a reason because you were motivated to buy a product, so they want to clear the path for you to do so, and this really clears the path. But it does hold customer value. It isn't just their idea of persuading you to buy more things. It holds value in the fact that it does make it easier. You are motivated to buy a product, and it makes it easier for you. So there's that balance. So it kind of goes to the right a little bit in that its intent, its roots are kind of persuasive, but it isn't necessarily manipulative because it is opt-in, and it does add value that you're pretty much you can recognize. On the other end of the spectrum where there's a little bit of a balance are things like good defaults, or often called smart defaults. That idea that you set defaults for people because you know that they're more likely to have those choices, and then someone who doesn't can obviously go through the other choices, and it kind of aids cognition, and it's kind of a cognitive shortcut where you're more likely to go through a funnel or complete a form because of that. And so that clearly is, you know, about utility or usability, or at least it's usually born from that thinking. Like, how can we help people fill out this form and not be frustrated, or go through this process and not be frustrated, and we can make it quicker for them and easier for them from a cognitive standpoint, from a standpoint of how much they have to worry about understanding before they go to the next step. But there is persuasion, and this kind of goes back to the documentary filmmaking. We are making decisions for the user, and those decisions mean they're less likely to look at what those options are. They're less likely to pause and say, oh, is that apply to me, or is it something that I shouldn't do? We see these things. They're useful, though. They're utility. I mean, I like them when I'm TurboTax, and I'm going through their steps, and I'm seeing like all the questions, and all of a sudden it comes to a question, you know, did you own a cow in 2009? And then it says, does not apply to most people. That's a cognitive shortcut that tells me, okay, I don't have to pause and sort of think, am I going to screw up my taxes if I skip this? I can say, well, yeah, that doesn't ring a bell, and they're telling me I shouldn't worry about it, so I can move on. But it is influencing whether or not I do pause and think about those types of things. Now, it doesn't mean you can't push those things to another side of the spectrum. You can push good defaults into a more persuasive way. Anecdotally, a lot of you may have heard this, so I'm just kind of going to summarize it, but there was a study that wondered why there was this great disparity in organ donation across these countries. I think in Europe or in Scandinavia and in Eastern Europe. And what happened was there was no middle ground. There were these countries that had, you know, near 100% volunteerism for organ donation when they were signing up for their driver's license. And then there were these countries that had, you know, down to the bottom 20% or 10% or 5%. And they couldn't find out the disparity, like geographically, culturally, socioeconomically. And what it turned out, it was as simple as the fact that on the countries that had high volunteerism for organ donation, it was an opt-out situation. It was already checked that you're an organ donor. It says, do you want to be an organ donor? You had to explicitly say, I don't want to be an organ donor. For the ones that had low, they were opt-in. They said, do you want to be an organ donor? And you had to explicitly opt into it. And that was the big thing. And clearly, there's a persuasive sense that if you have someone opt out of it and their default is to opt in, they're less likely to pause, they're less likely to think about it, or they just really don't care either way. So whether you opt in or opt out, they really were just sort of glancing over it. So you can kind of push things like those defaults into a more persuasive way. But it's generally about the intent that is used. But you also see that it's not a binary thing. It's sort of this mixture of the customer value you get or the value to the user, along with what your intent is and where you want to get them to act. So I'm adding another axis to this. So that bottom axis is that usability to persuasion axis. And then I'm adding an awareness axis. And the awareness axis is the awareness of your intent as designers. So it's the awareness by the user, by the customer, of what you're trying to do with your system. And I think that'll become clear if that sounds a little squishy. So if we're looking at the good defaults, we know they are sort of typically are to the left on the usability, but there is some sense of we're guiding behavior there. And then if you look at awareness, you know, it isn't macro. It's not like we're stating this big value proposition. But at the same time, we're not trying to conceal anything. Typically, if they're executed in the right way, you get a sense that, you know, the designers or the system is helping me make these decisions. You're definitely not concealing it and trying to fool them. So it kind of is a little bit up there. There's kind of more of a perceptive or intuitive awareness, even though there's not an explicit awareness. And you can have other elements here that are like progressive indicators, and we see other design patterns that you know are sort of designed to give you those cognitive shortcuts or to help you, keep you motivated to go along with a funnel or a system or some type of transaction. And then we know where the Amazon one-click goes, where it's a little bit more on the persuasive side, still has some user value. And again, almost everyone I've talked to knows that the reason one-click exists is to get them to buy more things. So even though it isn't an explicit value proposition, they're not stating we want to get you to buy more things, so click now. They're not concealing it either. I think they were opt out when they first came, or there was some controversy. So that implementation is really important. But now that they're opt in, most people who know what it exists for. And then I created that gray line in the lower right. And so what that gray line is the ethical scary area. This is where manipulation and deception exist. And the thing is, if you have all persuasion with adding no user value to it, no customer value to it, no intrinsic value to it, what you're doing is you're persuading completely for your own self-interest. And so that's going to be manipulation. And if you create no awareness to the point where you're probably concealing your intentions, so you're at the bottom of the awareness scale, well, that's going to be deception. You're deceiving someone. You're actually concealing your intentions. And so you'll see things like this. I think it's not, you know, freecreditreport.com comes to mind. There's this whole idea that what they're selling is a free credit report, and there's a lot of people that feel victimized that they sign up, and all of a sudden they're getting recurring charges. So they're not being upfront. They're not giving you a very much awareness about their intent. So they're being very deceptive. And also, their idea is to sort of promote one thing when they're really technically selling you another thing, a recurring charge for monitoring. So that's going to be manipulative. So that's the ethical gray area. And there's lots of ethics that we can get into, and that would also be another whole presentation you can go to. But, you know, this is the way you can kind of at least say it looks like a duck, it talks like a duck, it walks like a duck, and to stay out of it. And then you can see that the things we've put out are sort of micro level. They're kind of these feature level things. And so there's sort of this line when we're talking about this that where the awareness happens in, and things that are feature level, because they don't necessarily have to announce their intent, are going to be a little bit lower as long as they're not concealing their intent. And then above it are things where we're going to see things that are more macro level, that are kind of about products and services and their value proposition. So from a utility standpoint, you might see things like Gmail and the idea that you know, they're not really trying to persuade you to do anything particularly with your mail. You can write your emails the way you want, you know, within their constraints, and they do have some. You can manage your email, label them whatever you want, delete them however you want. They're not really dictating how you manage your email or how you use email or leverage email or send email. But you can imagine how you could push that a little bit to the right. There's a product called Shortmail, and Shortmail is a new email service, or I think it's been around for about a year now or so, but it restrains you to 500 words, and I don't think you can use any attachments like images. And the whole idea is that there's people who say, I have 2,000 unread messages, I have this email bloat, I never get to emails, and I never want to write those emails. So it's sort of wanting to help you manage that by giving you constraints that are going to influence your behavior around email. But going back to the utility side, these are products and services that we've typically associated with technology. This was the great differentiator between what we're experiencing now and what we've typically thought about technology and computers and networking for, managing information or managing things that are essentially virtual objects. You know, you have iTunes for managing your music. You have Basecamp for managing projects and other like software. You know, Basecamp is something that they, 37 Signals, the company that designs the product, has sort of deliberately constrained. And they say it as sort of a value proposition. They've been very deliberate in how they've edited the software features. So in a way, you've pushed it a little bit more to persuasion because they've created enough constraints that are going to dictate your behavior around managing projects versus something that is much more utilitarian and says, well, we're going to give you all the features and you can manage your projects in any way you like. But nonetheless, it's on the utility side. It's this idea of managing projects, managing your music, managing email. And then we see things that we recognize going into the upper right. This is the persuasion area. But again, it has high intent. They're stating a value proposition that's designed to say that we want to help you change your behavior. You want to change your behavior. So Weight Watchers, Nutrisystem, smoking cessation, these are things that have started to adopt into our technology-enabled world but have been around for a long time that are about behavior change. And then we see things that we've known, the Nest thermostat, Nike Plus. So there's this explosion of products that we've already talked about. Almost all these have to do with data, getting feedback loops on that data, and telling that story in order to manage behavior change. You know, whether it's your weight and keeping track of it, or it's keeping track of points and calories, whether it's how much you've run, what your altitude was, what your mapping was, or your Nest and what your temperature is and your energy consumption is. So this is the area that kind of represents behavior change in as far as that whole design principle and the designing to support behavior change that I talked about earlier. And so it's basically behavior change as value proposition. And this is an example I have Ready for Zero that is about a year and a half old. And they're a company that helps people get out of debt and helps them, from a behavior standpoint, curb their spending and improve their credit and improve their debt standing. And they do it in a way that's a little different than something like Mint.com because they're much more explicit about it, although I would say Mint.com is also in that upper right area. So some of the characteristics of behavior change as value proposition is the fact that clearly the value proposition is directly related to behavior. Things like Gmail and Basecamp and iTunes aren't directly directed to your behavior. They're directed to the objects that they help you manage and not necessarily the behavior and how you manage them. The system makes pretty explicit recommendations or guidance, whether it's going to be something like Ready for Zero that is literally going to tell you what steps you need to take to reduce your debt, or something a little more passive like Mint.com that's going to say, well, here's a bunch of credit cards that gives you a lower interest rate than the credit card you're using now. Data collection is the primary feature, the primary mechanism. Again, I think that's sort of the founding, the underpinning of all this. And then the behavior or the activities is measurable. You're going to get that feedback loop. And then there's a sort of a scaling self-determination. Again, use Mint.com. It can help you guide your behavior, but it's a little more implicit. Ostensibly, it is kind of a utility to help you manage your money. There is sort of that sense like you do that in order to better spend your money or better control your behavior around your spending or your savings or hitting your financial goals. Whereas something like Ready for Zero is something where it's very prescriptive. You can opt in. You have self-determination to use it. But once you use it, if you're using it correctly, you don't have self-determination. It's going to guide you and tell you explicit recommendations that you need to follow. And if you don't, you're kind of just not using the system right. And that's what a lot of things like weight loss systems are doing as well. They're going to prescribe to you either a set of meals or they're going to prescribe to you these set of points calculations. If you don't follow that, then you're not using the system correctly. So you have, if you follow it correctly, you lose some of your self-determination. You're not actually just using it the way you want to use it. And then they're highly personal. And, of course, something like short mail might not be that personal, although email is almost like getting so important that it has become personal. But obviously we know that this is something that tends to live with personal issues, health, environment, finances, personal habits. There's a product out there called Green Goose, and it was in beta for a long time, and I've been wanting to use it. And what they've done is they've created these sensors. I mean, we know that it's not just the mobile phone that's helped enable it. It's all the sensors that are packaged into it, geolocation, accelerometers. And what they do is they've put these motion sensors and these GPS sensors on things that you can attach to everyday devices, like a toothbrush. So it really is the Internet of Things starting to come to life. The fact that you can take any object and sort of make it networked and connected, and you can track your daily habits around those things. And again, that's going to be your personal habits. How many times you walk the dog, you put a monitor on your dog's leash, you put a GPS on your dog's leash, and it'll recognize the fact that you've gone for 3 walks a day, and it might scold you if you only took him for 1 walk a day. So I think we've sort of seen the landscape, where this sort of lives among products and services. So finally, we're going to talk about how we apply it. And it's sort of like, how do we start to recognize this in things that we typically do? There's things like strategy and research. There's kind of a new thing about behavior heuristics. We have design principles we often design against. And then we do things like experience mapping. That's something that's becoming more prominent now as you have sort of services or product systems that occur over time and in different contexts. So you start mapping the touch points along that. So if you were to start from a strategy standpoint, that's sort of your business perspective. And you kind of recognize what kind of company you're in, what kind of value proposition you have. So where does your value proposition map? So if we looked at that graphic, it's sort of like, are you in the utility standpoint, or are you doing something now that is about people's personal behaviors and in the persuasive design standpoint? So you ask those questions, and you also, when you're talking about behavior design, you need to ask whether you're trying to just change the behavior or you're trying to change the attitude. Because you could do things that will make people recycle more. Whether or not they change their real attitudes about recycling, you could make it a big game and offer actual incentives and rewards if they recycle, or make it competitive so they feel good about themselves for recycling for more reasons of that personal motivation of competitiveness. They might not then think to recycle when they're out and about and they have a piece of trash in their hand at the at a bookstore, and whether they have the recycling bin or the garbage bin. But then there's the idea is your goal to actually change people's attitudes as well as their behaviors? Or is it more that I just want to see results? I need people to recycle more. I don't care how they do it and what they think about it. So those are the kind of questions you would ask yourself if you are seeing that you're in that sort of persuasive design category. And it kind of depends on whether you're going to do something that's more implicit or explicit. So is it going to be more like Mint.com or more like Ready for Zero? And it's kind of when you're looking at it, whether it's a utility or a persuasive design, you can kind of start as well, are your goals around possibly integrating, if you've decided, well, we should evaluate whether for this product or service we want to like get into behavior design or persuasive technology. Is the question, is your goal things about conversion? Is it about getting people to use that system in a certain way? Or is it about a value proposition? Is more macro and it's more pervasive around the whole product? So if you decided that you still are doing the utility, you still want to be the next great email application or the next great music management application, there's still that idea of where then do you affect, where in your system do you affect behavior change? So that's why you the exclamation point means, okay, we've kind of decided this is where we are as a product on the map, but below, what are the features that we might have and where do they map that kind of involve persuasion? Those are things like onboarding and signups and profile completions. That LinkedIn was famous for having their little profile completedness and that being sort of a persuasive technology to motivate people to give them that more information and complete their profiles. Transactional funnels, just like e-commerce. If it's on the behavior change standpoint, then it's sort of like, what is the story's hold? Now, you know the ingredients now. There's things like data, there's things like telling the story, and there's the feedback loops. How are people interacting with the system? What is that value proposition to make sure that you're mixing the customer value with the business value? When you're doing something like that, we know that if we're all the way on persuasion, that's the whole manipulation part. And what we want to do is we want to make sure that there's customer value, but we also want business value because we want a sustainable business as well. And then we again ask ourselves, is this implicit change or explicit change? Let me get some water. So the strategy now is going to drive our research. And typically when we do research, what we do is we have questions we want answered. We get 2 or 3 core questions that we know we want answered by the research that we're going to conduct with users, the qualitative research particularly, but even in quantitative and doing things like surveys. What are we trying to get out of that research? What questions do we want answered? So this isn't going to look too much different than the type of research you typically do, but it's going to be just slightly much more in mind and thinking about behavior. So you are going to tackle these key components that you want. You're going to look at motivation. You're going to look at knowledge, which is going to be people's awareness or understanding of a product or service, which is obviously going to influence a lot of how you tackle them because they need to have a certain confidence level before they decide to engage in any behaviors. Any doubts and barriers, that's kind of interesting. So, if Mint.com, even though that's great, they can passively collect your data, the first thing you have to do is be comfortable with the fact of the security issues and the privacy issues. Do you need to address those from a feature standpoint in order to get them to then engage in the system and get the more larger macro benefit? And then the ability is big. It drives how that story is told and how they're able to engage with the product or service. And so you can't necessarily, if it's qualitative research, you don't necessarily give it a hard quantitative measurement, but you do sort of want to map the spectrum of those. You can kind of, thumbnail it and say whether somebody, we're dealing with somebody, we want to create this new thermostat product, and we're dealing with somebody that kind of have, when we've talked to people, they're kind of moderately motivated. So you kind of want to make a measurement of that. They kind of care, they hear a lot about it, so if it's in the right price point, and they know that their neighbors are doing it, maybe they would want to do it. Versus somebody who's highly motivated, and they say, this is something I'm really passionate about. Those things are going to affect, the types of products you do, and especially the types of messaging and how you position those products. So you kind of create this mental model, but with a behavioral profile, knowing those specific things that typically are the guts of thinking about behavior change. And when we do research in general, we usually frame it as getting to the thinking, the feeling, and doing, understanding what people are doing in their lives, and especially then how the product or service has a role in that, and what they're thinking and feeling during that journey. And there's a new thing that I'm just starting to learn about called behavior heuristics. And I think the term has been around a little bit and has been associated with game design. But Dan Lochten, that PhD candidate out of Brunel University, has been talking about it a little bit. And I was actually fortunate enough to go do a workshop in Dublin at the Interaction Conference that happened in February, because I was really interested in learning more about this. And basically, behavior heuristics are these rules of thumb that people might follow when interacting with a system. And it's kind of, kind of like the research, it's sort of a flavor of something that probably is already recognizable. But he's sort of asking questions about how they've behaved in certain ways with technology that led to answers which were sort of resolvable into something like rules or heuristics or principles. So, the way he does it is your goal is to sort of peel back the layers, and you peel back a few layers of symptoms to see if you can get to the cause. And so in this case, he used, from the workshop, he used this idea of Amazon.com, and we were really actually kind of reverse engineering. We were deconstructing something. But it's that idea that if you ask something like, well, people will follow what other people do, and you ask why, in the case of, say, book recommendations for Amazon.com. So you can get two reasons. People will follow what other people do is because they don't know or don't understand how it works, so they're looking for guidance or help. Or people will follow and do what other people do because they trust what other people will do. And you ask why, and why do they trust that? Because these people, their peers, have had a good track record of making recommendations before, so there's that credibility. Or these people are subject matter experts, and so their authority I trust. And then all of a sudden you can get to the idea of adding behaviors or heuristics, because it's either a matter of they trust a certain amount of authority and credibility, or they trust the peer track record. And that's why if you start too high at a level and you just think, let's just add a pattern like social proof to something because people will people like to do what other people are doing, then you're not really getting at the core of the problem. You're not really addressing the key behavior. Or you start throwing patterns around just hoping that these different things, social proof and credibility and liking, will sort of do the trick. But if you kind of use these behavior heuristics and peel back the layers, you can actually be a little more focused and probably a little more effective. And it's similar to a research technique called the five whys, which is sort of where you do that. You start by saying how somebody does something, and you ask why, and then it goes into, and after three or four or five layers, you kind of get to the causality of the problem, which will give you something more of a design principle. And that was the outcome of this. The idea was to peel back the layers, ask these questions, and sort of get these principles. So if the idea is, if lots of people are doing something, then show directly how many people or what proportion of people are doing it from. So what you've done is, once you get to the idea that if lots of people are doing it, do it, then you get a design principle you can design around. And that was something that I typically use a lot, which are design principles. Design principles give you that great thing to start ideating and designing around, yet without giving too many constraints. And I think you can do this in a way that starts to keep behavior in mind. These design principles, they might seem abstract, but I just pulled them randomly from an actual project that we did for a financial services company. And so what we were able to do is distill these in design principles that can affect our design, things that we can start to align sort of interaction models or design patterns to. So learn while doing, suggestions, not choices, have to do with the fact that is kind of related to defaults, but it is also related to the credibility of the financial institution. They had a high credibility among their members, and so they actually looked for the system to help them with defaults. So we actually knew that that was a viable pattern to start making some suggestions for them because they trusted enough that they wanted that kind of guidance. Providing conceptual anchors is having to deal with those doubts and barriers. What we were dealing with was life insurance. It was very abstract. People didn't know if they paid $100 a month in order to get a $10,000 benefit or if they paid $10 a month in order to get a $100,000 benefit. So we realized we needed to do things around addressing those. And those not always about behavior design. It's about addressing those fears and doubts in order to get them in a place where they want to then move forward from a behavior design standpoint. And the key with principles is they can't be too specific. They can't be tactical. They aren't about, because you don't want to sort of hem yourself into a specific thing. They have to add context to what you're doing. They have to be relating to the research and add context, but then something where you can ideate around and come up with multiple sort of more tactical solutions around it. And then mapping. A lot more of my projects, even if they're not service design projects, deal with sort of the idea of mapping journeys and understanding how people interact with touch points over sort of time and space. And those are great opportunities to create a framework in which you can evaluate a customer's journey with a product or service and understand the context where behavior design might apply. So kind of abstractly looking at a map, maps add context. You understand when they're interacting with something, and you understand a little bit about where they're interacting with something. You're able to analyze ability a lot better when you map things out. You can sort of start seeing where the story exists in their lives. And then you can map those touch points to things like motivation, knowledge, doubts, and barriers. Is this a point where we have to address those concerns and those doubts and those barriers? Is this a place where we can put one of those triggers or have an opportune moment to put that, you know, call to action in there? And then you want to, again, identify trigger opportunities, but also then see how that story is told. Where is the data collected? Where are the opportunities for that feedback loop that we've given? So it's kind of high level, but my main goal for me is to make a lot of this stuff less abstract and more applicable to my lives. And I think it's got a lot of room to progress even further so that we can see even more tactically in our process and methodologies where it applies itself. But hopefully in sort of showing where it is in the landscape and then showing where some of that stuff goes into our processes and methodologies, it becomes something we're able to sort of not just apply, but apply responsibly, apply for the right reasons, mix in the right customer value. I always like this quote because we often think about designing for behavior change. So we're thinking about our designs influencing people's behavior. And Paolo Antonelli, who runs MoMA or was a curator or executive curator for MoMA, actually kind of wanted to flip it and said, this feedback loop is continuous and it's a dialogue. So our products and services have to evolve as we get the understanding of what these behaviors are. So we should look at what kind of impact people's behavior have on our designs, not just what our designs have on their behavior. And with that, I really appreciate you taking the time.